Hello, I'm Glenn Nashin. This is number 0396, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0396. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a return visit from sci-fi writer Robert J. Sawyer. He's back on to talk about his latest book, his 23rd novel, Quantum Night, which is just coming out in paperback.
When I started researching Quantum Night 5 years ago, of course, only The Simpsons had ever predicted that Donald Trump might someday be president of the United States. But if you mapped the continuing incremental shifting to the farther and farther right by the Republican Party in the United States, we could see a very clear trajectory leading towards this kind of authoritarian, and as I call him in the novel, a psychopath, ultimately ascending to the highest office, certainly in the United States and arguably on the entire planet.
Dr. John Huber from Mainstream Mental Health in Texas on when you should consider going to see a therapist.
I recommend that for is to build a network of people, in this case a therapist, who when the world does turn ugly and everything's beating you up, you don't have to go, I don't know where to go get help. You've already got a solution for you in place. So I'm not saying you need to go see that therapist every month when things are going well, but maybe check in once a year. You do it with your dentist. If you have perfect teeth, you're still going every 6 months. Why? Because we want to keep things going perfect. It's kind of the same situation with mental health.
Theme park expert Pete Trabuco is back to talk about Disney's plans for Star Wars Land.
It's going to be 14 acres. It's going to cost about $3 or $4 billion to actually complete. It's going to have a life-size Millennium Falcon. You're going to be able to ride through the Millennium Falcon, get a feel for what it's like to be behind the cockpit, you know, with Han Solo and, of course, Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan and so on. It's also going to have massive land walkers that are going to be there that are going to be able to actually do stuff as well. You're going to be on an alien world. This is going to be a world that you've not been to yet.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0396 was Glenn Nashin, the Associate Director of Communications and Media Relations at CU's Integrated Health and Social Services University Network for West Central Montreal. You should see how big his business card is. Yes. Thank you very much, Glenn, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And the Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Be a patron of the show and find out about our rewards program. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the Stuff File program and even some of your ideas for rewards. So come on, participate and join us for the ride. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram and be part of the Stuff File Nation. Okay, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A man who arrived in New York from a trip to the Dominican Republic was found to be sporting some unusual underwear. 10 pounds of cocaine. U.S. Customs and Border Protection said Juan Carlos Galen Luperon, a U.S. citizen, was wearing pants that appeared to be rather snug and was showing signs of nervousness when he arrived at JFK International Airport following a trip to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. Luperon was taken to a private search room where officers found about 10 pounds of cocaine duct-taped around both of his legs. The cocaine was valued at more than $164,000. This seizure is another example of our CBP officers being ever vigilant in protecting the United States from the distribution of these illicit drugs, said Leon Hayward, who is the acting director of the CBP's New York field operation. Luperone was arrested and turned over to the Homeland Security investigations to face narcotics smuggling charges. You know, there are a couple of television shows that I watch regularly because they are a major source of endless fun for me, really. It's the show Border Security. Now, there are four different versions of the show. The Canadian one, the American one, the Australian one, and the Colombian one. I don't watch the Colombian one because it's the only one that's an hour, and it seems to be a one-trick pony of endless suspected drug seizures. But the other three are a hoot, and it never ceases to amaze me the amount of items people try to smuggle into various countries. It's also a revelation of the amount of people who bring large quantities of food with them when they travel, none of which is ever allowed in. Perhaps Juan Carlos should have watched one of these TV shows, but then again, that horse is now out of the gate. Authorities in Oregon say a man who stole a street sweeper led police on a 10-mile chase. Hillsborough Police and the Washington County Sheriff's Office said a private contractor was using the street sweeper to clean a Winco parking lot at around 3:45 a.m. and got out of the vehicle to use a handheld leaf blower. Investigators said a suspect, later identified as 33-year-old Tyler Hogwood, jumped into the street sweeper, which still had its engine running, and sped away. Hillsborough police pursued the street sweeper in a 10-mile chase that reached speeds of 65 miles per hour before the vehicle was stopped by spike strips laid out by sheriff's deputies. Hogwood was arrested and charged with vehicle theft, reckless driving, attempting to elude, unlawful entry of a vehicle, unauthorized use of a vehicle, and a parole violation. So clearly, he's been a guest of the state before. Don't you just love the irony of this story? I mean, he steals a street sweeper, but he couldn't make a clean getaway. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a snowmobiler came out of the woods to get back into his car near Carbondale, Colorado, to find that his pickup truck had been smashed up with a baseball bat. The unidentified 32-year-old man found a note on his windshield saying, "Sorry, anger issues," and sorry was spelled S-O-R-R-Y-Y, yes, two R's, two Y's, anger was spelled fine, issues was spelled I-S-U-S-E-S-H. Police pieced the situation together when they found two witnesses to the crime. They said they had been snowmobiling with the man who had been drinking all day, and when they got back, they heard whacking sounds. They saw the man smashing and kicking the truck because of the way it was parked, and it made it harder for him to leave. They insisted that he leave a note to pay for the damages. They also told police that there was plenty of room for the man to pull out. All he had to do was back up a little. Police found the unidentified 53-year-old and arrested him for felony criminal mischief. You know, one way to know that you're too drunk to drive, you slur your speech even while writing. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? One of the most prolific sci-fi writers is Robert J. Sawyer. We spoke to him last year after he had just released his 23rd novel. That was called Quantum Night. Well, it's now out in paperback, and some of his older titles are available in new Kindle and Kobo ebook editions. The Hugo and Nebula award-winning author joins us once again via Skype from Toronto to talk about it. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Always a pleasure.
So I want to touch base again about Quantum Night, because one of the things that's always interesting about your books is they seem to, I mean, they're sci-fi. They look at things from a scientific point of view, but they also, in a way, seem to be politically correct, or not politically correct, but politically astute and foretell the future. Are you cornering the stock market too? Is that...
Well, the one stock prediction I would not have made would be that the Dow Jones would go through the roof with all-time highs after the election of Donald Trump. But I was very much aware of the fact that Donald Trump or someone like him was likely to be sitting in the Oval Office around about now. When I started researching Quantum Night 5 years ago, of course, only the Simpsons had ever predicted that Donald Trump might someday be president of the United States. To everybody else, it was an unthinkable idea. But if you mapped the continuing incremental shifting to the farther and farther right, by the Republican Party in the United States, looking at the election 9 years ago, then the one 5 years ago, and certainly the one last year, we could see a very clear trajectory leading towards this kind of authoritarian, and as I call him in the novel, a psychopath, ultimately ascending to the highest office, certainly in the United States and arguably on the entire planet.
I take it you haven't sent him a signed copy of the book.
Yeah. You know, in the same book, I have Naheed Nenshi, who is the current mayor of Calgary, ascending to the highest office in Canada. He becomes our prime minister after Justin Trudeau. And I did send him a signed copy, and he loved the book. But I'm halfway torn here, Peter. I got to tell you, on the one hand, I send a copy to Trump, and he tweets, "Terrible writer, awful book, sad." And my sales would be gigantic. I mean, there's nothing better for sales these days than to be dumped on by Trump. But on the other hand, you know, I have to move back and forth between the United States and Canada periodically on business. And I don't want to get the ire of the current guy who has his fingers in a lot of pies.
And the border folks, too, which is always an interesting situation these days.
Well, borders are what the Trump presidency was all about, isn't it? You know, we seem to think, and as a science fiction writer, you know, and I know you're a Star Trek fan like me, we look into the far future and we see the United Federation of Planets, not just one world, but a whole bunch of worlds coming together. And this seemed like we were well on the way to that reality. And then, oh my God, Brexit, the European Union, the closest thing we've had to a stable, voluntary coalition of countries falling apart, and then the United States talking about an insanity in terms of expense, building a border wall and closing its borders to those the most in need on the planet. Unbelievable turn of events. Very, very disturbing.
Yeah, but you see, as you say, I am a Star Trek fan, and I am, for the most part, a very optimistic person, but I saw a note of pessimism in the whole Star Trek genre, and that is that I've always stated worlds only seem to come together when they collectively have a bigger enemy.
That's right. And it's funny because certainly I don't think anybody wants to go to war with the United States, but collectively, in a lot of ways, Trump's presidency is becoming a rallying point. Canada has upped its game a great deal of late. For instance, the $600 million that we're going to spend on healthcare and on reproductive rights and women's healthcare around the world is directly in response, no question, to Trump saying, no, we're not going to do that, defund Planned Parenthood and so forth. I think we're seeing a lot of people realizing it, who never had political alliances before, that we do kind of sort of in a way have a common enemy right now, which is the rise of an authoritarian in power in what we thought was a liberal democracy.
Okay, so you've written, as I mentioned, 23 novels. And one of the reasons we're talking right now is because you've just recently released many of them for e-readers. Looking back at your 23 novels, because they're usually set, if not in the distant future, in the somewhat near future, have a lot of the things you've written about, have a lot of things that come from your mind come to pass?
It's been very gratifying. Now, remember, part of the job of a science fiction writer is sounding warning bells. So sometimes the last thing we ever want is for one of our predictions to come true. But in general, yes, it's funny you should mention that I've got a number of my older titles out for Kindle and Kobo, ebook platforms. I was writing about ebooks and electronic newspapers back in 1996. They figured very prominently with economic models very similar to the ones that actually ended up being adopted. In my novel, The Terminal Experiment, in that same novel, I rightly predicted what the name of the Pope succeeding John Paul II was going to be, that it was going to be Benedict XVI, which seemed to astonish a lot of people that I was able to figure out which name was due for a comeback in Vatican City. So there are a lot of little technologies and a lot of things that just seemed to me that if they didn't exist, somebody was bound to invent them. But I'm a science fiction writer. I'm like Arthur C. Clarke, who invented the communications satellite. And he has a T-shirt that says, or he's passed away now, of course, but he had a T-shirt that said, "I invented the communications satellite, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt." So we're great at throwing the ideas out there, but somebody with deeper pockets and a more entrepreneurial spirit ultimately makes them come to pass.
Well, you're a science fiction writer of today's generation. Going back to some of the science fiction writers like you just described of a previous generation, was it easier or more difficult to write science fiction in that time when using just your imagination? The reason why I bring that up, I take my grandmother for an example. She lived through, my grandmother was born before the turn of the 20th century. So she lived through all of the imagination that took place right up until man landing on the moon and all the things that brought us up to in her case, when she passed away, into the 80s.
Yes.
So she could never imagine some of the things that she witnessed through life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we now live in a time where no one can really be amazed by something because we can almost all imagine it. Nothing is really out of our realm. Does that make it difficult for you as a science fiction writer?
It does make it difficult. And remember that some of the great inventions of science fiction, such as time travel, for instance, in fact, have no basis in reality, but are such common coin in our pop culture and just in our own wishful thinking. Oh, if only I could go back and fix that mistake I made 20 years ago, that to invoke that sense of wonder and astonishment and awe at what science and technology is right now or in the future will make possible is much, much more difficult today. We're talking in areas that aren't common coin. Quantum physics, whether or not we live in a multiverse with different versions of reality. We're much more interested in film Arrival is a good example of this from last summer, in the psychology of aliens rather than just whether or not aliens might exist, which was sort of the simple question that we used to ask. So spaceflight, sure, it exists. We know it's there. Robots, they exist. They're putting everybody out of a job. Aliens, we're almost certain that they exist. And so we're moving way beyond the simplicity of, hey, what if there were aliens, to, well, what if they subtly consider this moral conundrum differently than we consider it? And so in some sense, it's very difficult, but in another sense, it's way more rewarding because the low-hanging fruit is gone. You have to work harder to be a good science fiction writer today.
One last question, and I want to bring it back to what you mentioned about Trump, and that is, after the election, I actually posted a tweet and a Facebook post, not lamenting the election itself, but my concern is, for me, when I read science fiction or I watch science fiction, it seems that nowadays a lot of science fiction writers have a very dystopian look at what the future might hold. And with the election of Trump, do you see that becoming worse in the sci-fi genre?
Yes, and I totally agree with you about the dystopian bent, and it is not one I approve of, despite the somewhat dark tone of my current novel, Quantum Night. Generally, I'm an optimistic author. The future is demonstrably better. The present is demonstrably better, than the past was. We live longer. We live healthier. We live with more liberty. We live with more freedom. We live with more things to amuse us. I mean, in 100,000 different ways, it's a better life. But the dystopian world seems so close at hand right now that things really took a left turn and they could connect for some. But I think in that case, it's important that there be optimistic visions. If we don't have any possible future to look forward to that isn't dystopian, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the hard work that has to be done by me and my colleagues now in the science fiction field is to portray tomorrows that are worth living for.
Well, to be optimistic, how can one find those books you're referring to that are now available on Kindle?
Oh, just go to the Kindle store or the Kobo ebook store and put in my name, Robert J. Sawyer, or they're all published by my little company. I'm a science fiction writer, so my company is called sfwriter.com. If you put that into the Amazon search engine, sfwriter.com, all the books that I published myself will show up.
Excellent. Robert, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for chatting with us once again.
My pleasure, Peter. Take care.
Sci-fi writer Robert J. Sawyer. His latest book, now out in paperback, is Quantum Night, and as you heard, many of his previous titles are available in ebook form on Kindle and Kobo. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is 0396, and you'll find links to Robert's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And just a quick reminder, March is podcast month. Many podcasters, big and small, are getting together to tout their favorite shows. They're asking you to do the same. List the shows you listen to or like to listen to on social media with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. Here's just a few of mine. Every Friday with Dan and Olivia featuring Dan Miles and Olivia Dabo. It's just fun chatter. It's like having a drink or a coffee with a couple of really good friends. Just don't get them started on Fleetwood Mac. Also, The Spoon with Robbie Rist, Tom Bowers, and Chris Jackson. Three irreverent, eclectic guys who debate whatever comes to their mind in a most fun way. The Kelly Alexander Show, which you often hear plugged on this program as well, and the Sound Off Podcast with Matt Kundal, a podcast about podcasting. Wow, who thought? A very fitting show for this campaign. It also features a lot of radio pros offering up their ideas and tips. So that's just a few. What's your list? Share them online and get the podcast word out there. Remember, use the hashtag TryPod.
A message from the American Podcast Council.
You and I know why podcasting is so wonderful, but in a recent survey, 45% of Americans indicated they're unaware of the term podcasting. Think about it. 45%. People just like you, living unaware. It's as if the term podcasting was just a word, like Folgenblurble, or Mockingturf, or Schleen. People in your community need help. All this month, we want you to find a friend, a relative, a curious stranger. Show them how to try podcasts. Then share your story on something called Twitter with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. Together we can delete podcast unawareness. Won't you help? That's TryPod.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about when to see a therapist. Plus, we'll talk about the all-new planned Star Wars land that Disney is coming up with. There's also an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that you can also be a patron of. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram and sign up, because listener-supported, fan-funded radio like this show can only survive with the kindness of you. Thank you very much. Police in Washington State said a cooler donated to a Goodwill store turned out to contain something far more valuable, $24,000 worth of marijuana. Monroe police said workers at a local Goodwill were sorting through donations during the weekend when they came across the cooler. Police stated in a tweet that employees were surprised when they opened the lid. The cooler was found to contain multiple baggies containing about a total of 3.75 pounds of marijuana, which police estimated had a $24,000 street value. Police are investigating, and the Goodwill store is checking surveillance footage to try to identify the person who donated the cooler. Well, I'd look for somebody going through munchie withdrawal. I'm just saying. Yeah. Okay, anyone who has listened to the show with any regularity knows that I really don't like cats. They're evil, little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. Save your email, folks, because you're not changing my mind. So with that in mind, you can imagine how I feel about these new cat-friendly restaurants that are springing up. I mean, why live with a cat if one cannot take it out for some wine together, right? Yeah. The Apollo Peak in Denver and the Pet Winery in Fort Myers, Florida, serve a variety of the real grape for humans and non-alcoholic proprietary drinks for the kitties to enjoy tableside or underneath the table or wherever the cats are. Pinot Meow at $12 in Denver, and Meow and Chandon, $15 in Fort Myers, are specialties, basically watered-down catnip, according to a February New York Times report, so the felines can also get buzzed. The wine outing is the human's preference, of course, with a loftier cachet than the happy hour most cats might prefer, say, a sardine bar. Oy, kill me now. Meanwhile, still with news of the pretentious, here's a quote written by apparently straight-faced CNBC reviewer Robert Frank in describing his meal at the Las Vegas Mandalay Bay restaurant Fleur. I tried the $5,000 hamburger and it was absolutely worth it. Yeah, the burger included Wagyu beef, foie gras, and truffles, and was served with a similarly inexplicably priced wine. The recent consumer challenges, an $18 cup of coffee at Brooklyn's Extraction Lab, a $100 bottle of Norwegian iceberg water, a $2,000 pizza at New York City's Industry Kitchen, which included caviar, truffles, and gold flakes, and a $25,000 taco at the Gran Velas Los Cabos Resort in Mexico, which featured caviar, brie, Kobe beef, langoustine, lobster, rare tequila, and once again, gold flakes. These are the indulgences of people who have more dollars than cents, clearly. And what's with all the folks eating gold flakes? You know, soon we'll have people panning for gold in our sewer systems. Yeah, you know what I mean. I went there. Yeah. A robber in Virginia ruined his own getaway first by breaking his leg in a jump off a balcony and then by calling authorities to help him. Police say 21-year-old Liul Yosef will be charged with burglary for robbing an Alexandria apartment and then jumping off a second-story balcony after the owner returned home. Fairfax County Police Officer Don Gathart said Yosef left tracks in the snow when he jumped. Officers say they were following the snow trail when they received a 911 call from a man in the vicinity saying he'd broken his leg. Responding officers matched the identity of the caller to the burglary suspect. Gathart said Yosef will be charged after his release from the hospital. Well, I'm assuming he might be considering pleading guilty. I mean, he really doesn't have a leg to stand on, does he? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a councilman in Overtonia, Sweden, introduced a bill, a motion, that workers be given paid sex breaks during the business day in order to improve well-being and thus job performance. Which job is he referring to? Anyway, the primary beneficiaries would be married, fertile couples, but all workers would receive the benefit, and employers, said Councillor Per Erik Muskox, would have to trust their employees because some surely would cheat, you know, by not having sex. During this time, what are those who are single supposed to do? That's what I'd like to know. Actually, on second thought, never mind. I don't think I want to know. Let's just move on. Let's just get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. When do you know that you need to see a therapist? That's the question we put to clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber. He's the chairman of Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. John joins us on the line right now from Texas. Hi, John.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Awesome.
One of the first things right off the bat before one even knows when it's a good time to go and see a therapist is it becoming more mainstream that people are accepting the idea that going to therapy is a good thing?
Well, that's what we're trying to help influence mainstream mental health. We want mental health to be mainstream. We want people to not be afraid to take care of their mental health. And so it's a slow process, but I think it is getting better.
Do you find in some cases that it may be cultural as well as, between the divide between male and female, one thing, Are women more prone to going to therapy than men? Men more reluctant to do so? And it is also, does it also break down culturally as well?
Yes, I think that what you just said is a fair statement. Women are more likely to go to see a therapist than men are, unless we're talking about veterans. Men, as hard as it is to get them to go see a therapist, male veterans go and see therapists at about the women are about 10% more difficult to get them to see a therapist because of that culture that they just came out of and being in the military. The military culture has done a lot to train our soldiers to be safe when they go out in the battlefield, but when they come back home and they need help, they train them that mental health issues are a sign of weakness and you're somehow broken and you're not of value if that happens. So women have taken that one step further because they don't want to be the reason why women aren't allowed to go and defend their country anymore.
Right.
So it's,
and the reason why I brought up the reason why I brought up cultures is I know from my own experience, I'm black, and I know that a lot of blacks don't want to go to therapy, for instance.
Well, blacks also have a lower suicide rate than the rest of America, actually, too. So
really,
maybe there's something to that. Yes.
And that's why I brought up the men versus women, because there's a machismo aspect to it too, which you also definitely have in the black community, and that real
yes,
men don't do
Hispanic.
This. Exactly. So is that something that has to be worked out too as well?
I think it does. I think there's a whole lot that we can do, regardless of the culture for men. We somehow are these pillars that are statuesque in nature, and we support everything on our shoulders, and we want our children to look up to us and all that, so we can't show any kind of weakness. I think as we look at getting help when you need help before things fall apart, that actually becomes a strength. If you wait until everything falls apart before you go get help, now it is a weakness. So.
Oh.
We have to change that perspective, I think.
Okay, that brings up the idea that if you're willing to go to therapy, the as you just described, what are the signs that, it's time? Because I would assume that some people, like you say, may wait until it's too late. What are the signs people should look into getting some therapy?
Well, one of the things I put on there is when things are going well, and it's not because, your world is falling apart at this point. What I recommend that for is to build a network of people, in this case a therapist, who when the world does turn ugly and everything's beating you up, you don't have to go, I don't know where to go get help. You've already got a solution for you in place. So I'm not saying you need to go see that therapist every month when things are going well, but maybe check in once a year. You do it with your dentist. If you have perfect teeth, you're still going every 6 months. Why? Because we want to keep things going perfect. It's kind of the same situation with mental health. And now when people come to you because your world seems to be going so well and they ask for advice, you may turn around and say, hey, you probably should go to talk to somebody, and I know this person. It's not like, well, I heard he's good or she's good. You can say, I know this person. Here's who I would recommend to go talk to.
And going to see somebody, like you say, when things are going well, it's almost like establishing your own baseline. Would that be correct?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. That helps me as a therapist when I'm in that therapeutic mode with my patients. If I know what going well looks like for them, I know what we're shooting for. And the perspective issue is important, because what my patients think is going well may not be what I think is going well. So what's important is their perspective. So when they walk in the door and their world's right, they're just checking in, that gives me that baseline you said, and I know where I'm shooting for at that point with clarity.
Another sign, I believe, is when someone that knows you and cares about you asks you if you're doing all right.
Definitely. Sometimes we don't realize how difficult things are for us. We think we're holding our own, so to speak. But the reality of it is, you may be wearing thin around the edges, And if somebody goes to you before you see it, it's still kind of one of those things that it's maybe not that big a deal for you to go and touch base with somebody, and two or three sessions, you know, you got your feet back on the ground and everything's going square again. So that's a really important time, too, when somebody's asking you about that.
And it's important to, I guess, listen when somebody asks you about that, because sometimes we have a tendency to want to shoot the messenger. And it's like, I don't have a problem. Why do you think I have a problem?
that's the truth right there. We don't want to see that we have any issues, because the stigma associated with mental health issues is that I'm perfect, I'm fine, I don't need any help. Well, fine is one of those words where you're not functioning well, you're insecure, you're neurotic, and you're emotional. So when people say they're fine, that's probably when they need to go see a therapist.
Another time I understand is if you're somebody who always assumes the worst.
Oh, yeah. Very, very big sign. If you can't see the silver lining in the cloud, if all you can see is the cloud itself, you need to sit down and reevaluate your perspective on life. And a therapist can help you do that, because you start expecting the worst, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've seen it 1,000 times. We see it. I mean, it's a common theme in movies, sitcoms, everything else. But it's a reality. You start planning for the worst, it'll help you get there.
This one I found rather interesting. You see yourself taking responsibility for other people's problems.
What a great defense mechanism then, to pretend like everybody else's problems are so much worse than yours, that you have to stop and go help them. In the process, you don't ever take care of your own problems. So it's a sign that you should go check out and see a therapist. In fact, a lot of the therapists and psychologists that I work with, one of the things we do is we spend time bouncing things off each other and making sure our lives are going straight, because that's all we deal with. I mean, people don't come to me when they win the lottery.
Now, again, I'm going to play the gender card on that particular one, because I'm just wondering if by nature, women being nurturers are more inclined to fall into that category than men are.
Well, taking responsibility for somebody else's problems and helping somebody else with their problems are two different things.
Okay.
We also talked earlier about, you know, when all you do is take care of other people's problems. If you're not taking care of yourself, it's an issue, period. But mothers, think about how grandmas are and stuff like that. They always nurture us, and they take care of their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And they're that person we lean on, you know. But if grandma's not taking care of herself, it's a problem. And that's where it becomes that excuse for not dealing with yourself. So taking responsibility for other people's issues, again, is a little bit different. We have to look at ourselves, and are we taking responsibility, or are we helping them through, but we're still managing our own life?
Because when people, especially if you come from large families, everyone seems to have a predisposition as to what their personality is like, and there's always the one person who is the nurturer, the one person who is the caregiver, and it doesn't seem to change through one's life.
Well, we all take on roles in society, and we do it even to a greater extent within our own family. And we have that person who's kind of the scapegoat, the problem child, so to speak. And that can actually, you know, it's problematic and bad for the problem child, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And when their world starts going right, they just start talking to themselves, okay, when is it going to hit the fan? When is this going to fall apart? Versus, you know, the other siblings who think that as long as their identified problem continues to have problems, their lives can't go anywhere but up. And we all play those roles. And it's funny how I get patients in my office who, when they stay away from their family, they're the identified problem child. And when they stay away from their family, they are having a good life. They're working, doing a good job. But then they go back to their family, start spending time with them, and it's just a matter of when the catastrophes are going to hit, because they fill in that self-fulfilling prophecy so well, and they play that role that they set themselves up. So we have to work with that, and families need to be paying attention. Again, if you go back to that first one, if you go back and you're seeing a therapist once or twice a year just to touch base, you can throw things out like that, and the therapist can give you ideas and ways to help cope with that individual and help teach them to cope with their own lives a little better.
I think the greatest takeaway in all of this and what we've been talking about is what you just said, the fact that the analogy you used earlier about going to the dentist. You go to the dentist for a checkup, even when your teeth are fine, you don't wait till there's a problem, correct?
Correct. And, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's that old wives' tale, but it's so true.
Dr. John Huber, thank you very much for being on the program with us. People can find out more information by going to your website. Can you tell us what the website is?
MainstreamMentalHealth.org. And if you go there, you can also find all our links to Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, all of our social media outlets. And we give daily updates. We got some interesting activities coming up later on this summer that I think are really exciting that people will be interested in. So I'd encourage y'all to come check out our site and link up with us on all our social media.
John, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Dr. John Huber, chairman of Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0396, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. This year marks the 100th anniversary of when the Girl Scouts started selling cookies. It all started in Muskogee, Oklahoma. The organization has seen a lot of changes over the past century, but nothing illustrates how much things have changed quite like this next story. The leader of the Girl Scouts in one of the largest metropolitan areas in the country once told me they had to sell 32,000 boxes of cookies every year in her city just to raise enough money to pay for liability insurance to protect themselves from lawsuits. That's right, 32,000 boxes, and troops in other cities have had to sell even more than that to cover their own liability. Let's be fair, though. The Girl Scouts have a lot of company. Such respected organizations as Little League Baseball and the YMCA must also devote substantial portions of their budgets to liability insurance, all because lawsuits, unfortunately, have become as much a part of life in America as Girl Scout cookies. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about Star Wars Land. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. But I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you right here, right now, on a program you could also become a patron of at patreon.com. 54-year-old Daniel Crowninshield pleaded guilty in federal court in Sacramento in 2016 to illegally manufacturing assault weapons that had no serial numbers, despite efforts to circumvent the law by claiming that his customers actually made their own weapons using his equipment. Crowninshield, known as Dr. Death online, an expert machinist, would take a blank metal casting and, using special equipment and computer programs, create the firing mechanism for a numberless AR-15, providing the customer presses a button to start the process. Pressing the button, Crowninshield figured, made the customer the creator, not a buyer or transferee of the gun, and thus exempted from federal law. Well, in February, Judge Troy Nunley, unimpressed, sentenced Crowninshield to 3 years and 5 months in prison. I guess he'll work the metal shop there. Nice try, pal. Nice try. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Theme parks are drilling down to become very specific about their themes. Disney recently announced an opening date for its hotly anticipated Star Wars Land. It's in place to take you to a galaxy far, far away in 2019. But to talk about it now, we are joined once again by Pete Trabuco, a travel and theme park expert. He's the author of America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks, and he joins us on the line from New Jersey. Hi, Pete.
Hey, good to see you again. Good to hear from you again.
Good to hear from you as well, too. The thing I find interesting about this particular park is it seems to be that theme parks are really honing in on that word theme. It used to be a time when you thought of theme parks, you thought of amusement rides and all kinds of things that were brought together by the fact that it was fun for the family or the kids. But now we're getting true theme parks where the entire park is one theme. You have Star Wars Land coming up in 2019. There are things like the Harry Potter. What's the idea with all these truly themed parks?
Well, as you know, back in 1954, Walt Disney himself created the first theme park with Disneyland, having several different lands, of course, Tomorrowland and you know, Fantasyland and so on down the line. This started the trend that basically has been going, and of course, Disney, no one does it better than Disney does at this point. So you're going to have themes, and especially now, movies are the really big thing at this point. If you've got a movie out there, it's most likely, if it's big enough, it's going to end up somewhere at one of these amusement parks. Of course, Universal Studios has Island of Adventure, and of course, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, Diagon Alley, and so on. These things are big, big, big business, and people love it. They want to experience what it's like to be in the movie, and I guess when Harry Potter came out, people wanted to go on that 3D ride. They wanted to walk through the town that, you know, that Harry Potter lived in London, and go to Hogwarts and ride some of the crazy rides that he might be doing. So things like that were very, very big, and it just blossomed into what now is Star Wars Land.
Is there ever a concern that today's franchise, as big as it might be, might not have staying power when we're talking about a theme park? I mean, we're talking about the expenditure to build something in the future that is to last a long period of time. Are people ever worried about perhaps the interest in a particular film or franchise might not hold out in the future that long?
Well, there's a lot of research. I'm sure that substantial research on this. Obviously, in 2013, it was first announced about this Star Wars Land. Obviously, when they bought Lucasfilms, they started getting involved in that whole franchise, and they started with Star Tours, which was very, very successful, continues to be successful. So when, you know, as far as Disney's concerned, and Universal Studios and all the places that are actually doing this, there's a lot of research involved. They know these are going to be classics that are not going to go away for a very, very long time. In the Star Wars Land, scenario, you know, they're spending billions of dollars, and they will lose money on that for many, many years to come. But in the end, when you get 50 and 60 million people just coming to the locations in California and in Orlando, you can make that up rather quickly. So even roller coasters like the Hulk over at Universal Studios, these are making money because you're incorporating a theme into them. And in the long run, you know, you can spend $20-30 million on an operation, just on a ride. But in the end, 9 times out of 10, you're going to come out ahead because people want to get involved and into that movie. And of course, Star Wars Land is going to do that. It's going to get you right in the middle of the mix of the entire movie.
Okay, so we know it's still 2 years away. But having said that, besides the name Star Wars Land, do we know anything else about it?
Well, we know that it's going to be 14 acres. It's going to cost about $3-4 billion to actually complete. It's a very expensive proposition for both locations. It's going to have a life-size Millennium Force or Millennium Falcon, which is an amazing ship as itself. You're going to be able to ride through the Millennium Falcon, get a feel for what it's like to be behind the cockpit, you know, with Han Solo and, of course, Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan and so on. It's also going to have massive land walkers, CATs, that are going to be there, that are going to be able to actually do stuff as well. You're going to be on an alien world. This is going to be a world that you've not been to yet. Looks to me like Disney's probably going to have another movie coming out sometime around the same time as this opens, in which you're going to actually see that world. But this is like a preview of this new world. So it's not going to be Dantooine or any of the planets that you've been on before. It's going to be a total different experience, environment. They're going to have a lot of actors, obviously. A couple shows are going to be there. And, of course, there's going to be, where you can actually participate in several of the rides that are occurring there. So it's going to be another land that's going to be comprised at both the Hollywood Studios in Orlando, Florida, and over at the Magic Kingdom over at Disneyland. So it's going to be a great place to go. There's a lot to do, and even there are pictures on the website, if you want to go to the different websites, that actually show the construction of what is being done. It's going to be a massive operation. Hopefully it'll be as fast as the Avatar, which is the Pandora, which is now going on and going to be opening this year at Disney World. So hopefully it'll be quick, but we'll see what happens.
Okay, the United States or continental United States, is a big piece of land. But let's look at it for a second like one smaller community, the whole continental United States. You've got this huge theme park opening that is geared towards Star Wars in Florida, another one being opened in California. You mentioned Avatar. There are other theme parks like this. With these huge theme parks being built, is it akin to, when you consider the whole country, is it akin to a smaller community where a big box store moves in and sucks the other the enterprises out of the way because they're just so large? In other words, how do other amusement parks that we know that are scattered all around the United States, how do they survive when these big behemoths are being built on either coast?
Well, that's a good question, and unfortunately, the only answer I could give you is that most of the smaller amusement parks are coordinating or actually combining or being sold or being bought out by the majors. For example, Six Flags has got almost two dozen. Cedar Fair's got, you know, over a dozen and a half. SeaWorld also, Legoland, Busch Gardens. I can go on and on. And of course, we've got Disney World and Disneyland, which have many properties all over the place. So a lot of them are doing it that way because they can save money in the long run if you combine and coordinate. Now, on the other hand, the smaller parks, like, for example, in your area, Laurent, small park, but at the same time is doing extremely well. Bristol, I guess Lake Compounds is doing very well. Hershey Park is a single location in Hershey, Pennsylvania, obviously doing extremely well. Kennywood in Pittsburgh doing very well. So you know, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for a real theme park, spend a lot of money, you know, get hotels included, and have a real good, you know, week or two vacation, you go to the bigger parks like we mentioned. If you just want to have fun, take the kids out. Remember, there's over 1,000 amusement parks in North America. So if you just want to take the kids out, go someplace, experience the culture. For example, I've been to La Ronde, and I think the culture there is incredible. It's so different than what you would find, let's say, at Six Flags Great Adventure in New Jersey. I love it. I mean, if laughter is universal, you don't have to speak the language in order to actually enjoy these rides and have some fun. So it depends on what you're looking for, but there is a trend to go bigger, faster, higher, and better.
Okay, so you're the theme park expert. We just talked about some of the new theme parks coming down the pike in the next couple of years. Of those that we've discussed, which ones are you the most excited about?
Well, obviously, you know, Star Wars is going to be a big thing. This year with Pandora is going to be a very, very, very big thing as well. There are new rides being added pretty much everywhere at this point. I always love Kings Island in Cincinnati, and they're coming up with a fantastic ride called Mystic Timbers, which I'm looking forward to. It's going to be a great ride, adding to all the different rides that they have there. The Joker is a ride that was first introduced at Six Flags Great Adventure here in New Jersey. It's a 4D type of a ride, which means you free fly. You don't know which direction you're going. It looks like a wild mouse on steroids, but you get flipped dozens of times. It's now going to be opening at Great America, also at Six Flags New England, and I believe also Six Flags over Texas. So these places really got some incredible rides coming their way. Now, I don't know if you remember the pictures that they were. There were pictures of the Jersey Shore where I live, where there was this roller coaster in the water at the Casino Pier. It was literally in the ocean. The pier actually fell down again. There's going to be a new ride there called Hydrus at Casino Pier. And for us New Jerseyans, and for people that love the Jersey Shore and love to go on rides, we can't wait for the opening of that so that we can go back on another ride, which is not going to be very small. It's going to be a nice height, and it's going to have a vertical drop of 97 degrees, so it's going to be a great ride called Hydrus. We're looking forward to that opening. So there's a lot going on all over the place, and, of course, Toy Story in Disney for next year is going to open up a new theme area as well at Magic Kingdom. So there's a lot going on.
We have less than a minute to go, but I just want to mention this. I mentioned the title of your book, America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks, but you've got a new one coming out.
Yes, I have a new one coming out. It's going to be my personal favorite roller coasters, amusement parks, and thrill rides. It's going to be coming out through Starry Night Publishing, probably in the late spring. and we're looking forward to that. It's going to be a great book, and we can't wait till it comes out.
When it comes out, will you come back and talk to us about it?
Absolutely, absolutely. We'd love to.
Pete, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Pete Trabuco, author of America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0396, and you'll find links to Pete's website and links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
And just a heads up, the mugshot of the three teenagers I'm going to tell you about in just a moment here on the Stuff File program, you can find their pictures in all their splendor and glory up on the Stuff File fan page in Facebook. Yes. Just take a look at that. Three teenagers were spotted trying to complete a drug deal just yards from a law enforcement center and right next to two patrol cars. So obvious was the deal in Ellsworth, Wisconsin, that it was called in twice by two different sets of officers. Two 18-year-olds, Desmond T. Trock and Matthew P. Jones, and 17-year-old Trace Schofield have all been charged with delivering THC after being caught with a quarter pound of marijuana. The trio was spotted by Pierce County Sheriff's Investigator Marty Shepler, who was pumping gas into a marked squad car when they tried to complete the drug deal. The deal involved a brown vehicle and a white vehicle, which pulled up together at the same time as Shepler watched on. A Department of Natural Resources Warden patrol truck was parked close to the brown vehicle. The warden and the deputy both called in to dispatchers, and the two vehicles were searched. Now, why? Oh, why would you conduct a drug sale in a gas station literally surrounded by cops with a police station just paces away? Well, one reason and one reason only. You're an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0396. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0396. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.